Accession number 16716, Canon Gervaise Markham, reel 7.
Canon Markham, reel 7. What happened next?
Well, we got ready to go to cross the channel. Chaplains were issued with motorcycles. These motorcycles, like all the vehicles, had to be waterproofed, which meant that they were able to go underwater off the assault craft and then get up onto the beach when you would unplug them. Fortunately, my Batman driver that I had at that time, he thought he knew how these things worked, and so I had to practice riding a motorcycle, which I'd never done before. I had a little truck, and I had the motorcycle was put on the back of the truck, and we sailed from Tilbury down the channel. Remember, D-Day had already taken place. We were on D plus 17 or so as reinforcements. When we finally landed on the beaches of Normandy, there was still very active battle going on. But my truck got ashore. I drove ashore on my motorcycle once we got it unplugged, and then I followed my vehicle as dusk was gathering along this road in France, not quite knowing where we were going to go, but following the light of the vehicle in front. It was only after about 2 miles that I realized that I was following the wrong red light, and I didn't quite know who I was following. There was someone on French soil. I didn't want to go too far in case I drove through into the German lines by mistake. I didn't know how deep the beachhead was. So I stopped in the middle of the night all by myself. And then, to my astonishment, I found a big marquee in a field, which was a field hospital of some sort, staffed by nurses, British nurses. So I said, this is the place to spend my first night in France. And I had a very comfortable night in a field hospital. But then next day I found my unit, who are not yet in action. But I had to report to the senior chaplain of the 50th Division, because our unit was still part of 50 Div, which, the bulk of which had already come over. Well, I followed the signs. Still, I got to found a senior chaplain whom I'd known for 2 years now, a great friend, Warner. And he was sitting in a little foxhole by the side of a field and said, I'm glad you've come, Jervis, and glad to see you. You're just the person we want. Now, I know you've been with 124 Field Regiment all this time, but I'm afraid I want to change this because the Durham Light Infantry have lost 2 chaplains killed in the last 2 days, and I want you to join them now. That was the end of my period with the 124 Field Regiment, and I transferred to the Durham Light Infantry, leaving behind my truck and my driver and my batman, feeling very naked, just going on my own now to an infantry battalion with whom I never had any contact before. There they were, was right up on the edge of the beachhead in contact with the enemy. It's a day-by-day situation. I'd never been so close to the enemy before. And I noticed that this is up till this period, all through the war, I had kept a diary, but my diary finishes at this spot because it was no longer possible. Life was so hectic to keep a diary day by day. But I joined the 8th Battalion, DLI, and learnt the trick of being in with a regiment in contact with the enemy, who were just, it was in this bocage country of deer fields with high hedges and banks under the hedges called bocage, and the unit was its front post, the front soldier of the infantry was looking through a bank in a hedge across a field to where the next field was, and there was a German looking back at him. That I did one day crawl up as far as this, because I felt, being with the infantry, at least I wanted to get as close as possible to the enemy. But that was what I could do.
In what ways did your work now change?
Now, of course, there were casualties every day, and the casualties were being brought back to the RAP, the Regiment Aid Post, which was in a little hut or farm cottage somewhere, I suppose, and it was liable to change day by day, because you might advance a field or two or half a mile and then you would move on to somewhere else. The whole thing was much more mobile and fluid from day to day. You never quite know what was going to happen. But the casualties would come in, and you would help with the medical officer, and the RAP staff, orderlies, would deal with the first aid. It was always noticeable that these orderlies would light a cigarette before dealing with a casualty. Not the practice in most hospitals, but in those circumstances, it somehow gave the man confidence to unwrap a bloody wound or whatever it was, and to deal with something very nasty of this poor chap who was lying in front of you. If you were smoking, at least these men found it easier if they were smoking a cigarette at the time. And then, of course, the casualties there went back to a field ambulance somewhere further back. As far as chaplain's duties were concerned, as I visited the men, saw their conditions of life. We had an officer's mess in some little farmhouse, but as far as possible, you kept underground. Every night, you dug a trench to sleep in, probably underneath your vehicle, if you had one, because if a shell were to land on you, that was the end of it anyway, but it protected you from splinters from other shells, which were, of course, flying about all the time.
Some men, casualties coming in, must have been extremely frightened.
Frightened?
Yes.
If they were alive, they were very thankful. Thankful to be alive, and now they were going to be looked after. They would be thankful that they would, if it was a bad wound, they would now be going back to England. this is a very real situation in troops. They're prepared to do their job, to fight, and to risk wounding. What they don't want is to be wounded in the testicles, for example, or to have something that will be very painful. But a wound in the arm or the leg means that you're out of action for a time being. You're going to be safe for the next month or two. You may be prepared to come back again, but at least you're safe for the time being. I mean, this is a very imminent and pressing thing. So if you're brought back on a stretcher and you're not able to walk, but it was what in the first place was called a blighty, remember. There's an awful lot of talk about soldiers raring to go and being full of fight and all that sort of thing. But what the fighting Canadian soldier really wants is to get through the battle without being painfully wounded or being killed, of course. But if he's got a slight wound and is out of action, well, that's for most young soldiers, that's a very thing to be thankful for. So he's glad.
A man who is dying, do you give solace? Do you help?
Yes, it's very seldom that actually happens. He's killed, and that's the end of it, and you go and collect the body and stretcher bearers, and you bury it somewhere. If he is very seriously wounded, he's brought back to the RAP on the stretcher, but he's got away as soon as possible to a field ambulance somewhere. In my experience, which of course is very limited to this, it is very seldom that the chaplain gets the chance of doing this traditional thing of the consoling someone who is about to die. You might think that that happened, but it was not my experience that it did often happen. Yeah.
Did you get in that close contact with the enemy situation? Did you get much opportunity to give services?
Yes, there were several on a Sunday. Well, you didn't actually bother about Sundays and weekdays were all exactly the same, but in different locations and at different times of day. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon was the best time we found. It was a sort of quiet time. You couldn't. You would stand to at dawn. And I always found a little place, maybe a farmhouse or barn or somewhere, which would be announced as there would be a service such and such a time. Anybody who was off duty would come along. Numbers may have been comparatively small, but everybody was very high pressure. But on the other hand, it was known this was going on. This was part of sort of the Christian life that the chaplain was there doing his duty, and it's a matter of consolation to a man actually that he knows first that he's got medical attention, that he'd get wounded he will have somebody to look after him, and secondly he knows that if he dies he's going to be properly buried. His next of kin will be told about it. He's not going to be flung into a grave like a dog. This does help morale in a strange way. The chaplain is there, and that that he will be in contact with your family and so on.
Outside of the paraded situation to go to a service,
there were no church parades. No, not at all.
Was it the case that men sought the Christian help that you could give them, where possibly away from danger in civilian life, you would never see them? Was there a closeness to God in that situation?
That was partly true, yes. I think it can be overemphasized. It was partly that you felt you were still an ordinary person who did ordinary things as you do in civilian life. It was a contact with the ongoing life of an ordinary person, singing a hymn that you'd sung at home, hearing the prayers, reading Bible, Gospels, stories that you associated with home. This was all part of being an ordinary human being as well as being a fighting soldier with a gun. And it helped to keep people human. They knew that the padre was not a fighting man. He's not trying to encourage them to kill people. He was their contact with ordinary, private, civilian Christian life, which went on in spite of all this bloodshed and war. That's the way I would interpret what I was doing.
In the Bocage, as you say, it was an extremely difficult situation, and then the fighting was very severe at times. How were you coping with that?
Well, I was young and foolish, and I remember the senior chaplain saying to me, "Okay, now, don't go and get yourself killed. A dead chaplain's no use to me, whatever. I've had two on my hands. I don't want... So be sensible." Well, but then I was with the infantry, and I thought, I want to share an infantryman's life. So we did have... we were going to make an attack over Montpinçon. Have you heard of Montpinçon? The 8th Battalion was going to make an attack from an orchard, the opposite side of Montpinçon. I thought, I will go with them to the start line anyway and see how this done. So we had a march of 3 or 4 miles, I suppose, along a road over the ridge and down to an orchard where the start line was going to be. So I put on my, well, we all wore tin hats all the time, and I put my things into a haversack and marched with the battalion along this road to the start line. Crossing the ridge was a bit jumpy because it was under observation from German gunners. You had to wait till a shell had landed, then you went across the gap as quick as you can before the next one came. Then we got down into an orchard, and I was with the signal officer and a stretcher bearer, I think, and the men were the front side of the orchard, ready to go forward at 0 hour. Well, obviously, I thought I will stay. The RAP is not very far away. I will stay with the stretcher bearer and the signal officer. So 0 hour came, and the infantryman went forward. Then at once, the Germans realized something was happening and started to shell the orchard. And we found we were in the middle of a terrible barrage with shells coming down at the orchard and all the apples being blown off the trees and that sort of thing. And we made a dash for cover, and we saw in a big bank a hole that the Germans had been there the day before. They'd dug it, so we dashed for this. Well, the quickest was the young stretcher bearer. He was the youngest. He got in first and managed to turn the corner. The young signal officer got next, and he crawled in, and then I got in. It was only about this high. And we turned around, and we crouched like this to see what was going on. Just sort of inside the door, there's this hole in the bank of the hedge. And then I remember there was suddenly a terrific blinding flash, and a shell landed just in front of us. I felt something hit my cheek, and then I was streaming with blood. And then I realized, good Lord, I'm alive. Oh, I'm alive. Then I looked around, and I found the shell splinter that had cut my cheek had killed the young man looking over my shoulder. The signal officer, he had been with us about a fortnight, a young chap. And so, what in fact the blood was streaming down was only a sort of hole in my cheek. It was nothing particular. In fact, I was soon patched up. But I remember, talking of the things that go through your mind, my first thought was, a blighty, I can go home. My second thought, a few seconds afterwards, good Lord, I'm alive. Life is beginning all over again. I've got a second chance. I'm alive. That was sort of Thanksgiving. I ought to be dead, but I'm alive. Life began again from that turning point. Remember that. So that was my sort of contact with the enemy. There.
Was there ever a thought or problem in your mind that there is God and there's all this death and destruction and maiming?
Yeah.
Did you ever face that question?
Preoccupation. Yes. We haven't talked very much about that, but that, of course, is the basic problem of all or chaplains or anybody who tries to equate the Christian faith with what you're doing in wartime. And this is a problem that always came up, of course. You can't avoid it. You can either become a complete pacifist and say, I will have nothing whatever to do with this war. I will opt out. I will do something entirely unmilitary, like being a milkman on a farm. Or something. The fact you can't completely opt out because you are helping to grow milk to feed the soldiers with in the wartime. You are all in it one way or another. If you are not a complete pacifist, or you can say, I will not do anything, even that, I will go to prison, which you're just being you're being fed at somebody else's expense, aren't you, without making any contribution to anything. So I've never taken that line of pacifism. I've taken the line that you have a duty to your country, and that you believe in Christian civilization. You believe that the Nazi regime is entirely unchristian and evil and bad for the world, and so you take the lesser of two evils and say it is better for us to try and defeat this evil Nazism than to let it spread over our country. And so in that case you have to be involved in the war to defend your country, your family, and the values that you hold dear. And if this as part of a war effort, though some people say just kill the Huns, kill Bosch, kill Jerry, kill Germans, in fact the object of war is to make the opposite, the enemy, stop fighting. That is your ultimate aim, without necessarily killing more than is necessary. In fact, like so many problems in life, you have to choose the lesser of two evils. That is an attempt to answer your question about how you equate God and Christianity with being in the army. Yeah.
After Mont Pinçon and Plessy Grimoire, which was the village just beyond, and you got involved in that particular action, where did you go to then?
Then the advance gradually began, and we started on the long process of driving across northern France, being feted by all the French people as we went, and occasionally having to stop and scour woods or whatever. We had a great day on the day of the liberation of Paris, when we had a wonderful celebration at a village called Beaufort, a great day with the mayor and the local community all joined together with us in having a Thanksgiving for the liberation of Paris, and they brought out the wine that they'd bedded during the Germans. They played the Marseillaise with their two or three instruments that they got for the first time during. It was a very emotional moment indeed. So we went on till we got to Brussels, and we then, with the downright infantry, we were involved in the Giel, Battle of the Giel Canal, which you've no doubt heard about from other places.
Do you recall what happened there from your point of view?
From my point of view, yes, I do. It was the troops had got to cross the canal. I was with the regiment, the RAP, Regimental Aid Post, which was in a barn of some sort. There were German tanks lurking about. Nobody knew quite where they were. It was all a bit scary, and of course there were shells falling all over the place. The casualties were coming in, and I remember I was talking to people on stretchers, and one lad came in, and I asked him where he came from, and I found he was the gardener's son from Morland House here. Who later became a colonel in the Hussars. He had a great military career, but He was there as a wounded reconnaissance officer, I think he was, in the Battle of Guil Canal. But it was a dangerous night because nobody knew where these German tanks were. And many people got shot who were not expecting to be shot at that time. The liberation of Brussels was a great occasion. We weren't the first people into Brussels, the guards were, but we got there on, I think, the first day, or perhaps the second day. My memory of the liberation of Brussels was that I went round to the English church in Brussels, where there was a tablet to Edith Cavell. You remember the heroine of the First World War? And this had been covered up during the war. And I remember saying, I will liberate Edith Cavell. We tore off the coverings to liberate Edith Cavell's monument again in the English Church of Brussels. Yeah. And we went to some evening party, drinks party. Some Belgians were giving the officers, three or four of us were there. And the Belgian ladies who were entertaining us were very forthcoming indeed. And after one or two drinks, they were saying, "Ah, you are English, sleep with me tonight, sleep with me tonight." Just as the situation was getting a bit tense, we suddenly got a messenger arrived to we knew where we were at this party. "Come back, we got to move across 4 o'clock tomorrow morning." So we were saved an embarrassing choice.
Can I just take you back a little while before that? Falaise Gap that you drove through rather than fought through.
Oh, yeah.
Were those seats particularly horrific?
No, not as far as I personally was concerned. We were not on a road which was going through where all these people had been massacred, really, but from the air. We were following on a side road. My memories of going past there was on the people standing at their doors offering us apples and pears and plums and things as we went past.
You were well received.
Very well received.
Through all the villages and places.
All the villages we went through, yes. Yeah.
Did you see any of the French punishing ladies who they thought had fraternized with the enemy?
No, I didn't see that at all. I wrote an account of this party at liberation, but there the great
this was published in Newcastle Journal once, I think.
What was the thing I was going to show you about? The mayor. We had a party with the village of Beaufort. We managed to put up a marquee, and the mayor and all the local people came to welcome us at very short notice. They dug up the wine that they'd buried in their yards, and we had the chef de resistance came, who was a hero. And a little old lady who looked like an old English nanny was their heroine, because she'd been a school teacher in Paris, and she'd earned great credit a year or two ago by shouting in public, "A bas les Boches!" And a German official at once arrested her and asked her to repeat what she'd said. To his surprise, she did so at the top of her voice, whereupon they imprisoned her for 2 months. And here she was, living in retirement as the village heroine. The village was very proud of her, and as they could not understand her speech themselves, they concluded it must be good English, and she got loud applause.